Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz. Ann is away today. She was about 5'1" tall, with brown hair and brown eyes, and although she had no formal education, Abigail Smith had learned to read and write at home and had read a lot in the extensive libraries of her friends and family. In 1764, at the age of 19, she married a local lawyer who was almost 10 years her senior and with whom she'd have 3 sons and 2 daughters. His name was John Adams, and as Abigail Adams, she would become one of the best-known women of her time and ours. A strong believer in equality and justice, she's noted for a remonstrance to her husband in the Revolution and as it was unfolding to, quote, remember the women. Helping us to do that is an excellent new book by our guest today, Woody Holton, called, and the book is called, interestingly enough, Abigail Adams, a book which recently won the Bancroft Prize. Woody Holton is a National Book Award winner finalist for Unruly Americans and the Origins of the Constitution. He teaches history at the University of Richmond and lives in Richmond, Virginia. Woody Holton, welcome to Hi. All Sides.
Hi, Ed.
Tell us, how did you become interested in Abigail Adams?
I was doing an earlier book on the origins of the Constitution, and one of the stars of that previous book was people who had speculated in depreciated government securities, and it's kind of a dry topic, and so I was trying to find one of these guys who speculated in bonds as a sort of a main character in my book so I could put a face on all the others. And it turned out that really the best documented of all these very highfalutin, unscrupulous financiers was not a guy at all. It was Abigail Adams.
Okay. Interesting. Now, she's had more histories written about her than most first ladies. How did you come to the conclusion you had something new to say about her?
Well, that was a challenge because you like when you're writing a book to either be discovering something new or to be saying, oh, these other books are no good at all. But the reality was that there are several great books about her. But I had a couple of particular sticks, interests of mine. A previous book of mine was called Black Americans in the Revolutionary Era, and so I wanted to write about her and race relations in general, and African Americans in particular. And that turns out to be a really complex story. She was very much against slavery, but as you know, somebody can be anti-slavery and also be anti-black. And sometimes she was. In some contexts, she saw the play Othello in London in the fall of 1785, and just couldn't handle it. You remember that's the Moorish general, black general with a white wife, and she wrote to her sister back home in Massachusetts about her disgust and horror, those were her words, at seeing the sooty black man touch the fair Desdemona. You know, it's something you'd almost see from a Ku Klux Klan website or something today, that she just could not handle the idea of interracial sex. On the other hand, she had been raised really by slaves along with her parents, and one of those slaves, Phoebe Abdy, became her great friend after Abigail's father died in 1783 and freed Phoebe in his will. The Supreme Court of Massachusetts freed her that same year, so she was sort of doubly free. And she and Abigail, for the rest of Phoebe's life, she lived another 25 years, were great friends. And actually, after both of Abigail's parents had died, she described Phoebe, her father's former slave, as the only surviving parent I have.
We're talking this morning with Woody Holton, the author of a new book about Abigail Adams, on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you have a question or a thought or a comment about Abigail Adams or the Revolutionary period or anything else along that line, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. Abigail was born in 1744 in Weymouth, Massachusetts. This was a decade before the French and Indian War, and really a little more than a century after the original settlement of Massachusetts. What kind of a world was she born into? What was the role of women in that world? And what did fathers and mothers really expect of their daughters in those days?
Well, I think the most important thing to know about her growing up was that she was a preacher's daughter. And she, the preacher's wife, had responsibilities that were as important as the minister's herself, his own. So, for instance, Elizabeth Quincy Smith, Abigail's mother, was sort of in charge of charity for the parish, and Abigail would accompany her on those charitable rounds. And I think that notion of one's duty to other people was instilled in all women of that era, but particularly women in a preacher's family. She was also really influenced by her grandparents, that is, her mother's parents, who came from one of the most prominent families, the Quincy family, for whom the town of Quincy would be later named. Her grandfather had been the Speaker of the Legislature for years. And, Ed, I have to tell you about a little discovery I made after writing the book, although I got it in time for the paperback version, which is just out. But it's not in the hardback version because Abigail didn't like her mother that much, which we could talk about, found her mother overprotective. But she loved her grandmother, who saw Abigail as kind of wild and appreciated that in her. It scared her mother that Abigail was such a wild young lady. But her grandmother had a couple of sayings. One was, "Wild colts make the best horses." And another of her grandmother's sayings was, "Abigail, someday you're going to make either a great woman or a terrible woman." And I quoted both of those in my book. But then just this last fall, I took a course on Plutarch, the classic Roman historian. He was actually Greek, but he wrote about Greek and Roman Greek and Roman public figures, one of whom was a guy named Themistocles. And I'm reading this biography of Themistocles that Plutarch wrote in like the 3rd century AD. And he goes, and he quotes Themistocles' father saying to Themistocles, "Themistocles, someday you're going to be either a great man or a terrible man." And another thing, Themistocles, yes, wild colts make the best horses. So my point to you, Ed, is that she was being raised in part by a grandmother who had read Plutarch.
There we go. Now, you mentioned in passing in the book that she later noted that one reason she did so much reading was that her health was poor and she didn't play cards, sing, or dance. Well, since she wasn't playing cards, singing, or dancing, how did she express this sort of wild cultness that you were talking about a minute ago?
The thing about not singing and dancing came from this strange letter that John Adams wrote her when they were courting, where he pretended to list all of her faults. And some of them seemed like real faults. Like he said she was pigeon-toed, and they called it parrot-toed in those days. And that she didn't she didn't cross her legs when she was sitting or something. And she wrote back saying, "A lady's legs are not a topic for a gentleman to be discussing." But most of his so-called criticisms were actually compliments, where he said that she was too fond of thinking and reading and writing, and not enough fond of dancing and other silly things. She spent a lot of time outdoors, to answer your question, just running around as a very young girl, just like to run up the hill next to her, near her parents' house, and things like that. But I think the wild thing, for instance, you and I wouldn't think of it as a wild and giddy thing to go to Harvard graduation, but she always wanted to go to graduation, even though she didn't know any of the graduates usually, because that was just a way to get out of the house, and it was actually quite a big party in those days, as I guess it is. Still, but her mother wouldn't let her go to graduation because she's afraid that she'd pick up a disease from other people. So the big thing is this, that she was kind of, and you see this in her later life too, she was a real risk taker. She wanted to get inoculated against smallpox. And maybe some of your listeners have seen the John Adams movie on HBO where they show how you got inoculated against smallpox. And what they did was make a slit in your wrist and they put a little thread that was covered with pus from someone who actually had smallpox, and so they would give you the disease as a way of giving you lifetime immunity to it, which you did get immunity if it didn't kill you. Mm-hmm. And so her mother, she wanted to get inoculated against smallpox as a kid, and you'd think her mother would be all for that because she was such a germaphobe, her mother was, but she didn't let Abigail do that. And it's interesting, her mother died in the fall of 1775, and by that time, Abigail is a wife and mother, and almost immediately after her mother died, she went and got inoculated.
One of the interesting things, I think, about the book, as you point out in passing, that one of the advantages of doing some research on John and Abigail Adams is that they wrote so many letters in the first place, and that the letters actually got saved, which is sometimes a neat trick, too, along the way, even with people who write a lot of letters.
Absolutely.
Why did they write so many letters? Is it just because they were letter writers, or did it have something to do with the fact that John Adams wasn't home all that much during that period?
Yeah. I think it's an interesting speculation. If he had been, say, he'd become governor of Massachusetts and kept that job for his whole political career or something until he moved to the Capitol to become president and take her with him, then you're right, we wouldn't have these letters. And in fact, their letters, they wrote to each other more than 1,200 letters that have survived, and several hundred more that we know about, but that didn't survive. By the way, I should mention that if anybody listening wants to go to Google and type in Adams Electronic Archive, you can get every single letter that John and Abigail wrote each other. The Massachusetts Historical Society sponsors that, created that website, and it's really good. You can either read, if you're gutsy, you can read the letters in the original handwriting because they have very good photographs of the letters, but they also have the typed up version. And so it's a blast to read their letters. They were both, I think, among the greatest writers of their age. She was an undiscovered great writer of her age, but Joe Ellis said, and I think really accurately, that Abigail was just incapable of writing a boring letter.
Now, you mention as well in the book that they call each other friend a lot.
Yeah, my dearest friend. In fact, that's right. The title of one of the other.
And in a period now when Facebook is making everybody friends one with another again, what does the word friend mean in the colonial period?
Well, that's a good example, Ed, of a word that has changed meaning. Because, you know, I think of, yeah, you're right, friend has now become a verb. And, you know, when I get a letter addressed to dear friend, it's usually from a creditor or somebody, you know. But in those days, it had a much deeper meaning. And so, in fact, in the most famous letter that Abigail Adams wrote, where she asked John and his fellow members of Congress, this is on March 31st, 1776, she said, "Remember the ladies." She said, "Don't treat us as your servants; treat us as a friend." And she means friend in the highest and best sense of the word. But that's one of the challenges of, I was just encouraging people to go read the letters that Abigail and John wrote each other. But there's one of the challenges of reading that. A lot of the language is really tough. It's like reading Shakespeare, and you really have to spend time to figure out what the hell they're talking about. But the hardest words are not the ones where you go, ochlocracy, what the heck is ochlocracy? But it's the ones where you think you know the word and you don't. But for instance, candor. John Adams, when he first met Abigail Smith, she was 15, he was 24. He didn't like her a bit, and he went home and wrote in his diary that she was not candid. And what if I called you not candid, Ed, you'd say, that would mean that you're not honest or something. But it meant almost the opposite of that. It meant that you were too honest. Candid. The word is used in the Declaration of Independence. It means, because Jefferson says, let facts be submitted to a candid world. Right. Candid meant non-judgmental, that is willing to overlook somebody's faults. And so when John said she was not candid, it meant that she didn't overlook his faults, that she pointed out his faults to him. And,
I see.
So she was kind of uppity, I think might be a word.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. We're talking with Woody Holton today about his new biography, Abigail Adams. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz. We'll be right back.
We packed up the political junkie and headed to New Hampshire, but not before we got some styling tips from Carly Fiorina.
God, what is that hair?
Well, that's why we work in radio. I'm Neil Conan, all the political news, plus we'll talk with Republican candidates for Judd Gregg's Senate seat. Join us for a special Granite State edition of the Political Junkie next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation is here from 2 until 4 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. And good morning. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. 75 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20. Morning clouds should be moving on, sunshine in the afternoon, and a high of 85 today. A few clouds tonight, a low of 62. Sunshine for Thursday, and a high of 82 degrees. And looking ahead to Friday, more sunshine and a high of 87. All Sides with Ann Fisher with guest host Ed Lentz continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
We're back. We're talking with Woody Holton about his new book about Abigail Adams. To pick up where we left off, we were talking a little bit about her independent sort of style. And you mentioned the letter that she had written during the Second Continental Congress urging her husband to improve the rights of women, or to at least remember the women. Let's talk a little bit about the rights of women in the colonial period. What were they?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at property rights, a widow or a single woman has basically the same property rights as men. But the second you get married, you have no property rights at all. So you could be a woman could be a billionaire, and the second she gets married, all of that property goes to her husband. That's personal property. The real estate she kind of technically owned, but she couldn't will it, she couldn't control it, she didn't get the profits from it. And so it's fair to say it's absolutely correct for personal property, which is everything except real estate, and it's in essence true for real estate that her property went to her husband. And that was one of her biggest complaints. Another of her complaints was about and the one that she mentioned the most. Everybody knows about the Remember the Ladies letter, but this is one that didn't actually get mentioned there, but it's the one she mentioned constantly, not just to her husband, but to other men, and especially in letters to her nieces, which are really powerful, and that is women being deprived of educational opportunities. She had had very little chance, partly because her mother, as I say, was a germaphobe and wouldn't let her out of the house, but also because there were so few schools, even at the basic level, that would take women. There's a sense, and yet you read her her letters, and she's amazingly literate. So she's partly, you just say, self-educated. That is, you know, she borrowed books from her grandfather's amazing library that had Plutarch and all these other big shots. She quoted Shakespeare all the time. And Ed, I got to tell you, one time I was on a talk show in Denver, one of these overnight shows, and somebody called in and goes, now, what would Abigail think about 9/11? And I was able to say, well, actually, she knew quite a bit about Islam, and she referred in one of her love letters to John about the Abarak of Muhammad, which I'd never heard of, but it was a winged horse that Muhammad flew around on, similar to Pegasus. And I was trying to say to this caller, in some ways, she's more sophisticated about Islam than you are, because who's heard of the Abarak of Muhammad?
There we go. One of the more interesting, I think, poignant parts of the book is you begin with Abigail writing a will. Now, as I understand these things, it was somewhat of an exercise along the way because, given the property rights that you just mentioned, she didn't have any power to make a will because her husband was still living when she wrote it, right?
Yeah, I defy anybody listening to this this morning to go find me a will written by another married woman. Mm-hmm. Widows wrote them all the time, right? Because once you're a widow, you've got property rights. Your property is your own. But a married woman is not supposed to own property and not supposed to write a will. So you can imagine me looking through the microfilm of the Adams papers and getting to the year 1816, and there's Abigail Adams's will, and I'm copying down the contents of it. And, you know, like most of the biographers, I wanted to go, okay, let's say what she says in her will, and then let's move on. But there was something bothering me about it. There's something wrong with this. It was almost like a Homer Simpson moment where I go, Abigail Adams's will. It's like this thing was banging on the outside of my head. And then I realized she really was not supposed to write one. But once I saw that she had written one, and it was not just a sentimental will, you know, about lessons for her grandchildren or whatever. No, she gave away the modern equivalent of $100,000 worth of property. Once I'd seen it in the will, I started to see it earlier. And in fact, it went back about to the time of the Battle of Yorktown, that she had started setting aside some of the family's wealth. And she referred to it as this money, which I call mine. So she knew it wasn't really hers, but she was declaring it hers. And I think the timing of that's important, that she started setting this money aside right as the Revolutionary War was ending. And I think that's not out of elation at the victory, but kind of the opposite of that she could tell by that time that the Founding Fathers had won the Revolutionary War, but the Founding Mothers had not. And that she'd asked her husband back in 1776, remember the ladies? He had written back saying, I cannot but laugh at that proposition. And so women had really gotten nothing out of the Revolutionary War in terms of having the rights that we've been talking about get recognized. And so this is when she decided, okay, I can't change the law. I'm just going to defy it, and I'm going to make my own home an experiment where we try this idea that women can own property. And she asserted ownership of this property. She built up a pretty good stock of it. Her husband knew generally about it, but she took great pains to hide from him what she was doing with this money. She used it to help widows and other women in the neighborhood around her. She helped her sister. One of her sisters married a preacher, which in those days is another way of saying that she was poor, and so Abigail helped her a lot. Her other sister married a genius, which meant that he was very impractical, and so that family got poor and poor, and she helped them a lot. She helped Phoebe Abdy, her father's former slave that I was talking about before. And then when she wrote her will, which, again, she wasn't supposed to do, in the eyes of centuries of legal statutes say women, married women can't own property, but she just wrote it anyway. And the interesting thing is, by that time, that's 1816, 2 years before her death, by that time she had several grandsons and nephews who were really in desperate financial shape and really needed money, and she left them nothing. She left it all to her granddaughters and her nieces and her daughters-in-law and her female servants.
And I guess the important question is that since the will didn't have any legal standing, what happened after she died?
Yeah, that is the $100,000 question. And it's interesting because if you read the first sentence of it, I've got it, I've reproduced it early in the book. If you read the first sentence, she says, I, Abigail Adams, do dispose of the following property by and with the consent of my husband. But John Adams' signature is not anywhere on there. And so when he found this document in his deceased wife's papers, he would have been completely within his rights and just throwing it in the fire. But the cool thing about it is that John Adams actually complied with it to the letter. And by his carrying it out, that actually transformed it into a legal document, because women, married women, were allowed to do all kinds of business transactions as agents of their husband. And they didn't need a power of attorney or any kind of letter from their husband. As long as the husband didn't object to what they were doing, they were considered to be acting as their husband's agent. So when John Adams carried out the will, that made it a legally binding document. I think this is actually their most amazing. You know, they did a lot of things together that are better known because they were public political events. But this collaboration, which was not known at the time and hadn't been known since, this to me was their sort of a most amazing collaboration. Partly because it was at her initiative, not at his initiative, and partly because, you know, the politics that really matters the most to most people is not who's the governor of Ohio, who's the president of the United States, but who's governing my household. And they had really changed the government of their household.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit now on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking this morning with Woody Holton about his new book about Abigail Adams. And if you have a thought about it, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk a little bit about the Adamses in Washington, D.C., since they were the first folks to really occupy the White House. Family came to Washington. It's fair to say probably it wasn't a particularly pretty place at that point in time.
that's a great understatement, Ed. She was pretty much miserable the whole time. She wasn't there for long. The arrangement had been – New York was actually the first capital after the Constitution was adopted, but they immediately made a deal where they moved up to Philadelphia for 10 years, and then in 1800 down to Washington, D.C., which it's not a pleasant place at this time of year anyway because of all the steamy, swampy environment that it's in. But when she got there, it was barely even a construction site, and the interior of this building – that was later called the White House was not finished at all. She hung her washing out in the, I think what's now the East Room, and she was miserable about that. She as I said, she hated slavery and saw really there had been slaves in Massachusetts up until 1783, and she'd grown up with slaves, but she hadn't seen a slave society, a society based on slavery, where all the labor is being done by enslaved black people, and that really shocked her, and she hated that. The worst thing of all, though, about that fall of 1800 is that that's when her son died. In some ways, her favorite son, this amazingly charming boy named Charles, who, you used to carry when you're dating, you used to carry your lover's a lock of her hair or his hair in a ring in your pocket, and his pockets were full of rings, all with hair from different girls that were interested in him. And so this guy had been a total charmer, but partly because of that, he had never really gotten himself together, and there was probably an alcohol gene in the Smith family line. He drank himself to death in the fall of 1800. So she was miserable, and then of course, while all that is happening, her husband is being defeated for re-election to the presidency. So that was probably the low point of her. Maybe her. She had a miscarriage or a stillbirth in 1777. It'd be hard to decide whether that was the low point of her life or the fall, the few months. She was only in Washington for about 6 months. I'm not sure which of those was the worst period of her life, but it was one of those two.
We have a call coming in. Dottie, do you have a question or a comment or a thought for us about Abigail Adams?
I'm sorry, did you?
Yes, you're on the air, Dottie.
Oh, okay. I knew John Adams was a Unitarian. Was Abigail Adams also a Unitarian or...
Yes, that's one of those few questions we can answer unequivocally. She wrote a letter to her son saying, early in the 1800s, saying, "I am a Unitarian. I can't see how one can be three and three can be one." And so she wasn't her whole life a Unitarian because, as you know, the movement within the Congregational Church towards Unitarianism really didn't begin until her adulthood. But she absolutely did become a Unitarian. Before that, from the earliest times that we can see her letters, she was a Universalist. That is, believed that everybody could or probably would go to heaven. For instance, she had a friend of a friend who committed suicide, and in many religious traditions, if you commit suicide, you're headed straight to hell.
Right.
And certainly Calvinists, many Calvinists would believe that the vast majority of us are headed to hell. There's only a few that God has selected out. And she was, even though she was a Puritan minister's daughter, she didn't like Calvinists at all. She thought that friend who'd committed suicide was going to heaven, and she often spoke very openly, not in public, of course, but in letters, about her distaste for Calvinism.
What was her father, a Unitarian minister, or was he a minister of another church?
Well, the Unitarians grew out of the Congregational Church,
right.
The Puritan Church, and her father was a Puritan minister. When he died in 1783, the notion of Unitarianism was just beginning, and so he never really wrote about Unitarianism, but he was skeptical of the Calvinists too. You might have heard of the Great Awakening,
yes.
We sort of associate with George Whitefield. I guess you could say it began in the 1730s and went right on in through. I mean, there were revivals in the early 19th century in Ohio that were part of this very decades-long movement that's similar to, in many ways, it's similar to evangelical or Pentecostal religion today. And many people got caught up in that, but both Abigail and her father opposed that. The word enthusiasm was a negative word for them, and they use that all the time to describe these Pentecostalists. The people who are derided today by some people as holy rollers, getting happy in church and shouting and so forth. They didn't like that at all. She preferred a much more sedate, not entirely bereft of sentiment, but a much more reasoned and quiet kind of religion than that.
So she was more intellectual regarding her religion.
Yeah, I don't want to go too far down that road because she also was critical of her home minister after she'd moved to, when she married John Adams, she moved to the town of Braintree, which her section of it later became Quincy. And she found the minister there too boring, that he didn't show enough. The word that she used was sensibility. She always described herself as a person of immense sensibility. Mm-hmm. Maybe you've read Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility.
Right, right.
You know, so she did believe in the power of the heart, and she didn't like people who were all about the head and reason and cold calculation. She didn't like that either. So you could kind of say she was a moderate. She believed in sentiment, but not as much as the Pentecostalists, and she believed in reason, but not as much as somebody like Thomas Jefferson, you know, who has the head win the argument between the head and the heart, at least theoretically.
Well, when did Joseph Priestley come then? Was that the same period?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
When did Joseph Priestley come to the United States and start?
He was a contemporary of her husband. I think he came over, didn't he come over after the Revolutionary War in the 1780s? Yeah. Moved to Northampton County, Pennsylvania, and she and John corresponded with Priestley. She did not.
Mm-hmm.
Now I will say, since you asked that, Dottie, that her religious views changed over time. As I mentioned before, Unitarianism wasn't an option when she was a kid, but she was ready to declare herself one early 19th century. And her son John Quincy, that was in a letter to her son John Quincy, who had written her criticizing Unitarians, and she'd gotten into an argument with her son about that. But another change in her religion, religious views, happened during the French Revolution. As you know, that once things got really radical in France, they really were attacking Christianity as well as the monarchy, and that's when she really turned against the French Revolution, because she was a strong believer that there needs to be some religion, and she also saw religion as a prop to the government. She actually criticized her husband in one letter when he was president. He'd made a statement in support of the concept, he didn't use these words, in support of the concept of separation of church and state. And she wrote him saying, wait a minute, let's not separate church and state too much here, because the state needs religion as a support. That is, you've got to have people fearing damnation if they commit crimes.
We have to take a break now.
Sure.
Thank you, Dottie, for your call. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz, talking with Woody Holton about his new book about Abigail Adams.
My family and I moved here 3 years ago to take jobs at OSU working for the Department of Dance. The great thing about the local programming here at WOSU is it's taught us a lot about Columbus, but the national NPR programming, it gives us a sense of home in a new place. My name is Michael Wall, and WOSU is my source for a broader community.
And you're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll celebrate Ohio and America's bounty of local farms, foods, producers, artisans, and restaurants with Edible Communities co-founder and the local publisher of Edible Columbus. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Cleveland State University's Graduate Certificate in Early Childhood Mental Health Counseling, providing the tools to serve in this in-demand field. Deadline for the fall cohort is August 1st. More at EngageCSUOnline.com.
76 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40 this morning. A few clouds this morning, sunshine in the afternoon, a high of 85. Clearing skies overnight, a low of 62 degrees, sunshine for Thursday, and a high of 82. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
We're back. We're talking with Woody Holton about his book about Abigail Adams. If you have some thoughts about the Revolution, Adams family, or Abigail, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or an email at allsides@wosu.org. Woody, I'd like to move on and talk a little bit about the Adams presidency. I was particularly intrigued from the book about Abigail somewhat acting as a proxy for her husband. That probably wasn't a common practice in those days. I noticed that she was attacked in the opposition press, so she must have have gotten some attention. I was particularly interested when you mentioned that she thought that the Alien and Sedition Acts didn't go far enough.
Right.
Could you explain to our listeners what exactly those were and what her views were about them?
Yeah, this relates to the French Revolution that we were talking about before the break, that there were many people, there was a great divide in the United States in the 1790s over whether to support the French Revolution or not. England was dead set against the French Revolution and a real hotbed of reactionary conservatism at the time in wanting to maintain the monarchy and an established church and so forth. And so Americans really divided into pro-French Revolution versus anti, and the anti side tended to be pro-British. And John Adams, and like Abigail, was a critic of the French Revolution, and we almost went to war, really did kind of go to war against the French in 1798. They call it the Quasi-War from 1798 to 1800. As happens during the current war, you've got critics of the war and questions about how many civil liberties, what should happen to their civil liberties. And Abigail saw the people who were criticizing her husband as not merely the loyal opposition, but as traitors. And so they were guilty of sedition and thought that they should be locked up. And a lot of members of Congress thought that too. And without John Adams asking for it, they passed a series of laws called the Alien and Sedition Acts that made it harder for new immigrants to become citizens, because a lot of people were immigrating from France and Ireland, which was also kind of a radical spot, as it has been for many times over the centuries. So they were worried about these French and Irish immigrants, and so they made it harder for them to become naturalized citizens. And they also said if you seditious statements in your newspaper or say seditious things, you can be locked up. And they locked up a few members of Congress and quite a few newspaper editors. Why was she more in support of the Alien and Sedition Acts than her husband? Because, I think she was just a very passionate person. That's one of my criticisms of that John Adams HBO special. It kind of made her look like the one, the port in the storm, who was always calming him down. But she was actually very passionate, and she just couldn't stand critics. I mean, this is true. You know, if you hate your boss, it's always your spouse hates your boss more than you do, and it was kind of like that. People who criticized her husband, she just couldn't abide, and she really couldn't see them as a loyal opposition. She saw them as traitors who ought to be locked up.
Tell us a little bit about her relationship and her husband's with Thomas Jefferson. You mentioned in the book in passing that the two men, of course, had something of a falling out, especially after Jefferson defeated Adams in the election of 1800, but that actually Abigail was helpful in reconciling the two men ultimately.
Well, she had a thwarted reconciliation. Yeah, they'd been friends in France. She described Jefferson as one of the choice ones of the earth. And then when Jefferson lined up in support of the French Revolution and John Adams against it, and of course there are a lot of other issues involved too, but that was really the fundamental one. They broke over that, and then Jefferson ran against Adams for president twice and won the second time, ejecting Adams from the White House in 1800. And they didn't communicate with each other for a long time. Then the president's daughter died in, I think it was 1804, maybe 1805, and Abigail had known her in Europe as a child, and wrote Jefferson a letter expressing condolences. And Jefferson, of course, acknowledged that letter, but he made the mistake of not just sticking to the subject, thanks for your condolences. Instead, he said, you know, the only thing that I ever disagreed with your husband about was, and he went into what he disagreed with John about. And that's like a dare to Abigail. She's not going to ignore that. So she wrote back saying, well, he was right and you were wrong. And it went back and forth for three or four letters in both directions until she finally cut off the correspondence. So actually, that was an almost reconciliation, but it really didn't happen, and John Adams never got involved in that. It was only 8 years later that Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration of Independence from Philadelphia, got Adams and Jefferson back together. So it could have happened with her, but it didn't. It kind of got into her defensiveness about her husband.
Okay. We have an email from Charlotte. It goes something like this. How was Abigail Adams regarded by her female contemporaries? On one hand, most women would have had to possess a strain of independent thinking as well as action to function in that time and place. On the other hand, a lady was supposed to keep her name out of print except for her birth, her marriage, and her death. Is the lady constraint actually a product of the later Victorian age?
It certainly got intensified. That's a great question that Charlotte asked. It certainly got intensified later, but no, Charlotte's absolutely right. It was already there. Women were not supposed to be in the paper, and she wasn't until the instance that you mentioned of where John Adams's political opponents made jokes about that they had somehow picked up that she was more anti-French than John. And I told you that it was a quasi-war between France and the United States in 1798-99. She was actually away from Philadelphia, which was the capital. She was back in Massachusetts in 1799 when he sent one last peace overture to the French. And a lot of people speculated that if she had been there, he might not have done that. And I think that those, you know, even though that's coming from political partisans, you have to take it with a huge grain of salt. I think they might be right. I think if Abigail had been in Philadelphia in 1799, John did listen to her advice. He often had her edit his public statements. And I can see that discussion going the other way, where she says, you know, the French have been nothing but insulting to us. Let's not send another peace overture. And so, interestingly enough, her absence may have prevented her absence from Washington may have prevented a war. But to get back to Charlotte's question, she did not have much of a public reputation among other women. I think she was seen as less gracious than her predecessor, Martha Washington, who came from an old Virginia family and knew how to host a party and was more social than Abigail was. So I think she was seen as kind of this awkward New England girl, which she hated that, and she hated being compared to Martha Washington. And, of course, when Dolly Madison came in eight years later, she would be unfavorably compared. Abigail would be unfavorably compared to her as well. But all these things we've been talking about, her political views, were unknown at the time. She kept that out of the paper.
I think one of the most interesting things about your book, and you've mentioned it sort of in passing, I'd like to talk a little bit more about it now, gets around to Abigail Adams essentially as an investor. While Jefferson and Madison died in relatively poor, the Adams family was very well positioned in its retirement, and most of that, as you suggest, is due to Abigail, the merchant and financier. Tell us a little bit about Abigail as a merchant and a financier.
Absolutely. And that's something that wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for the Revolutionary War. But, of course, thousands of American men went off to war. John didn't do that, but he went off first to the Continental Congresses and then to Europe as an American diplomat. And he was pretty much gone from 1774 till 1784, and Abigail joined him in Europe, and they were gone for another 4 years together. But she was separated from her husband for those 10 years. And sentimentally, I mean, in terms of her psyche, those were really difficult years. As I said, she had a stillbirth during that year. She actually blamed the stillbirth on her anxiety at having to go through the pregnancy without her husband there to support her. And she pointed out in a letter to John, you know, even a lot of the brute creation that is savage animals often have their mate with them when they're delivering their kids. And so that decade from 1774 to 1784 was a miserable decade for her. And yet it was wonderful financially, because John Adams put Abigail in charge of the family finances, and she ran them much better than he ever had. He was conservative in his economics and his sort of personal finances. He thought the only kind of real property to own was land. And so he was just accumulating land around his own farm in Braintree, Massachusetts. And as Abigail pointed out to him, well, that's all well and good, but you're making 1% a year as an annual return on your investment. And she was making up to 20% per year on her favorite investment, which was in depreciated government securities. I mentioned to you, that's how I first got interested in writing a biographer of her, was when I discovered that she was speculating in these government bonds. You know, every war we fought has been paid on credit. It's the most expensive thing government does, is go to war. And that the Revolutionary War, they basically paid the soldiers not with real money, but with IOUs. First was continental currency that evaporated, and then with these final settlement certificates that they gave the soldiers at the end of the war, saying someday the United States government is going to give you $300 to pay you for your 6 years of service in the war. And the problem for the soldiers is that they couldn't they couldn't wait until someday to eat and have clothes and so forth. And so they had to sell these war bonds at a fraction of the face value. And Abigail was one of the people who figured out early on that you could buy these things at a very low rate, and then the interest was figured on the face value of the bond. And so even the interest, she made a killing on the interest. And then after the Constitution was adopted, with her husband's strong support, after the Constitution was adopted, the federal government finally got the taxing authority it needed to redeem the bonds, and she made a killing on these depreciated government securities.
I see. We have a call coming in. Paige, do you have a question or a comment about Abigail Adams for us for this morning?
Yeah, I wanted to say that I love the book. I actually listened to it on the way to Florida a few months ago, and it was a terrific way to pass the time. I really enjoyed the Abigail Adams firsthand account of the Revolutionary War. It was really interesting to hear about just how close she could be to the soldiers and how much firsthand action she saw.
Oh, I'm really glad you mentioned that, Paige, because that was yet another hat that she wore. I've mentioned all these others, but at least during the first year of the Revolutionary War, the Massachusetts was the scene of operations, and they were constantly raiding parties where the British would raid a loyal town and the loyalists would raid. There were all these islands out in Massachusetts Bay that both sides tried to control because you could raise crops and cattle on them. And she was like Ernie Pyle. She was a war correspondent with these up-to-the-minute reports that she sent down to John and that he shared with his fellow delegates in Congress. So you're absolutely right.
Well, thank you. I really appreciated it.
Okay. Thanks for the call today. We've mentioned in passing her relationship with her children. Can we talk a little bit more about that? I was especially intrigued by her relationship with John Quincy.
Yeah, it's a tough but fun question, her children, because somebody asked me about halfway through writing the book as I was describing it. She goes, "Do you like Abigail Adams?" And in many ways, of course, I do, and I really admire her, particularly this asserting the ownership of property when you weren't supposed to do it as a married woman. But there's some pretty unlikable things about her. I think this bond speculation stuff is kind of unscrupulous. But another thing that you might not like about her is her relationship with most of her kids. She had four kids who made it to adulthood, three boys and a girl. And, you know, her main complaint, as we talked about at the start of the hour, was that her mother was too overprotective and too bossy, telling her what to do, and she was exactly the same way with her own kids. For instance, her parents had not wanted her to marry John Adams because he was just getting started and wasn't clear that he was going to be financially successful, and so they wanted her to make a more mercenary marriage, and she defied them, and although they delayed the marriage, she did marry John Adams. But then she did the exact same thing to her own kids. John Quincy wanted to marry this 16-year-old girl, which was not too young in those days, who he later described her to his wife. He later described this Fraser girl as the only woman he ever loved. But his mother and father they couldn't legally stop him, but they jawboned him into not marrying Eliza Fraser. I think her first name was Eliza Fraser, or Rebecca Fraser maybe. Didn't marry her, and ended up marrying Louisa Catherine Adams. And they really were not. They had their moments, but they were not very happy together. And the same with her daughter. She was very critical of her daughter. She found her daughter to be lacking in sensibility, that is, sort of too cold. And she compared herself as, "I can be pretty passionate," versus, "My daughter is kind of dull." And her daughter hooked up with a guy, I mean, not in the modern sense, but she was dating a guy named Royal Tyler and really wanted to marry him. John initially, he was in France, and his initial letters from France said, "No, you can't marry this guy." But then he changed his mind and wrote a letter to Abigail saying, "It's okay, Nabby can marry Royal Tyler." And by that time, Abigail had turned against Royal Tyler, and she burned the letter rather than passing it on to her daughter. And that marriage was thwarted, and Nabby ended up marrying another guy who her parents approved of, and he turned out to be a total disaster. And she was miserable with him. So she could be pretty controlling with the kids.
Now, John Quincy Adams did not attend his mother's funeral, as I recall. Is that right?
There's some debate about that. He was Secretary of State in the Monroe administration at that time. Was it Madison or Monroe? I'll do my math in a second. But he was Secretary of State, and he was down in Washington, and that would have been a pretty long trip. And so it's a debate about whether he was making a statement by not going to her funeral or just that he was too busy.
I also noticed that when she was approached later in life to publish her political letters, she refused, saying it was improper for a woman's private correspondence to be publicly divulged. But then one of her sons later went on and published them anyway.
One of her grandsons, John Adams's. But for what it's worth, he waited until almost 30 years after her death. Charles Francis Adams, who of course became his father had been Secretary of State under President Monroe, and he later became an American diplomat. He had kind of taken the family position. Charles Francis Adams later took the family position as American ambassador in London, the job that his father and grandfather, John Adams, had, and he became the family historian. One thing that Abigail would appreciate, I don't know how she would have felt about you're probably right, not so good about Charles Francis, her grandson, publishing her letters. He did totally edit them, though, and took out anything having to do with the body or, you know, family scandals or anything.
Okay. When she died in 1818, it was said that her only regret was that her family was not there. I thought that was kind of a poignant little point to...
Having the family together was everything to her, she really had the experience of the opposite of that from her brother, who had drunk himself to death.
Yeah.
And because of his bad financial situation, his kids had to be distributed among Abigail raised one of them, her two sisters each raised one of them, and so forth.
Well,
and that was always her nightmare.
Finances.
Go ahead.
We're going to have to conclude on that. We've been talking with Woody Holton about his new book about Abigail Adams on WOSU 820 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lance.